Good morning and welcome. You're tuned into 2SER 107.3 and it's Saturday morning. Must be time for some books. You are listening to Final Draft and I am your host, Andrew Popel, bringing you every week books, writing and literary culture for your reading pleasure. Two fantastic new Australian books today. One that just blew me away, absolutely loved. Some new noir, I'm kind of describing it as Sunburnt Reservoir Dogs, from Ian Ryan. It's called The Student, and it is one of the most interesting, messed up campus novels I've ever come across. That's going to be on the show today. Also, from Final Draft producer Jen Worgan, we've got a new YA cli-fi novel. It's called How to Be by Bren McDibble. If you haven't come across cli-fi, it's climate change fiction exploring what's happening to the environment in that sort of science fiction-y way. Another fantastic book with a really important message for kids. That is the show today, so do stick around. We're going to take a short break right now, and then I'm going to be back with Ian Ryan's The Student.
Secret Sounds are excited to announce the return of Iceland's musical treasure, Sigur Rós. Back in Australia for the Splendour in the Grass Festival, Secret Sounds have announced a Sydney show. When last in Australia, they were reviewed as complete and utter perfection, a stunning musical and visual journey. Spend an evening with Sigur Rós, Tuesday, July 25, at the Horton Pavilion. Tickets available at secretsounds.com. Secret Sounds, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Good morning, you're tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. And I'm speaking today with Ian Ryan. Ian's debut novel, 4 Days, was shortlisted for the Ned Kelly Award, and his latest novel, The Student, is something of a nightmare vision of university life in the 1990s. Nate is enrolled in a business degree in Gatton. It's 1994, but it hardly seems worth it as he's far more astute making money dealing weed. That is, until local supply dries up, his best friend goes missing, and the bikies come knocking on his trailer door. If your uni days were like this, I hope you got help, because this is a hard-boiled ride into regional Queensland. Think Reservoir Dogs with a tan. Ian, thank you so much for joining me for this chat.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for that wonderful intro.
It felt really hard to encapsulate this story, but what I said to myself is I can't give away any spoilers, and that was where I felt like we could go safely. I wanted to start first, so I want to ask you a little bit about heroes, because The Student feels like a novel desperately in need of a white knight to come in and clean up the whole mess. You deftly play with the notion that Nate may in fact be able to clean himself up long enough to sort out the trouble he's in, only to see him dive deeper into a stupor. And then I wondered, perhaps I'm applying a fairly cardboard cutout vision of what heroism is, and that Nate might be the hero that's needed in the circumstances. What were your thoughts on heroes and heroism in the Student?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I don't really see Nate as a hero. I definitely don't see him as an anti-hero, though, as well. I think that the anti-hero in hard-boiled fiction and also in TV at the moment is getting a little bit long in the tooth. Mm. But I think that his friend Iris is something... She's a little bit more heroic in that her actions don't always present in a really heroic way, but she is definitely the most she's active and like really trying to solve the problem.
That's interesting that you say, because as I was thinking about heroism and writing this question, Iris popped to mind, Jesse also popped to mind. There's a real sense, at least in the beginning of the book, that if Nate can just find Jesse, things are going to be okay, which makes him a hero of sorts under the circumstances. And every time you dangled that sense of heroism there, I felt like you snatched it back, even with Iris, and it makes it so much a darker place. There's even a point where the leader of the bikies, whose name escapes my mind, I think it's Murph, he seems almost like a hero just because he can make the whole thing stop.
Yeah, it kind of gets to that point, right? I mean, it gets to the point where, I think a little way into the book, where you just desperately want him to, for the situation to improve. And the way that it's a bit of a slow burn, I think the first act of the book in particular, that The relief doesn't seem to really ever come until like right at the end. I think there's sort of some sense of relief, but no one's really able to help Nate. And unfortunately, Nate is not particularly good at helping himself.
Are we allowed to have relief if this is it sort of a hard-boiled noir? I mean, noir's like a bad situation and it can only get worse. Does relief defeat the purpose, maybe?
A little bit. I think that, you know, I try to... I mean, the book is pretty heavily plotted and I'm not that sort of writer that is sort of obsessed only with character. And there's certainly really great noir writers that work almost primarily with character. Raymond Chandler is probably the most famous example. He cared almost only about character and not about plot. And I'm not like that at all. In terms of, I think that there has to be some sort of resolution at the end, but the resolution can't be tidy. It can't be like a return to law and order, and it can't really be a win for the protagonist if it's going to be noir.
Yeah, I want to ask, you've evoked some classic noir there with Raymond Chandler, and I've actually been reading a little bit of Aussie noir. We had Peter Pilates on the show a few weeks back with his debut novel Down the Hume, which is a very different type of noir to what you've written. But when we think noir, it evokes trench coats, misty darkened streets, Jimmy Cagney. It's a far cry from Sonny Gatton. And as Nate just... we can't avoid it. But as Nate descends into the world of drugs and violence, we do really see this darkness, despite the blaring sun even perhaps highlights it. What do you think makes noir work in Australia, though?
That's really hard. I'm not sure. Even though I write in that register, and I have done in the past, I think that 4 Days really fits into that hard-boiled sort of noir. And I know those things are not exactly the same. And I suppose this book is slightly more noir and my previous book is probably more hard-boiled. The way I approached it was that I thought I was writing a campus novel that would have elements of crime fiction about it, because that's what I knew from writing the previous work. And the more that Nate started to develop as the plot came together, the more and more he started to become that. He's a teenage boy, so teenage boys are often very stoic, and not so much from a position of strength or philosophical understanding of the world, but from the fact that they don't complain very often, they don't talk about their emotions a great deal, and they don't ask for help. And that I just sort of started to find these weird symmetries between Nate as this disillusioned teenage boy and, you know, the hard-boiled detective from noir fiction. He sort of goes down the mean streets without, you know, fighting the system or the chaos of the city or whatever else.
And he's stoic to the point of, oh God, I don't know, to the point of death almost. It's a visceral, violent ride that you take us on. I think the only thing that distracted me from the continuous beatings you subjected Nate to was just this enormous collateral damage that comes to Philly's world. I've watched enough horror to know that violence is easy to do badly, but this is bruisingly real in The Student. How did you get to that place?
I'm not sure exactly. I mean, I have been beaten up, so I drew off that. I mean, that experience of being beaten up as a person is helpful in that context. It's probably the only context in which it was helpful. And I understand the choreography almost of that experience, which is that it's completely non-linear. Like, you don't really understand what's happening to you while it's happening to you. And in terms of the violence of it, I'm not sure exactly. I try not to, with the violence and the sex, I try not to make it too, there's nothing decorative about it, really. It's kind of a matter of fact. I mean, the best that you could say about the writing when it comes to violence and sex in the book is that it's efficient, I think, and maybe minimal.
So restraint plays a role then? Because I found also there's a few dead bodies in this book, and I'm not going to talk about who, no spoilers here, but there is that sense that you present them and then leave the reader to examine and imagine them themselves. And one thing that really stands out to me, if I think about a particular corpse that Nate stumbles on, is the smell. that's the really evocative thing that you give us. And you don't linger over details. You just, excuse the phrase, leave that smell kind of hanging in the air for the reader.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that I am really interested in about violence. And I'm really interested, I suppose, in crime novels that have some kind of, I suppose my morality about the crime novel is that I don't want it to be only entertaining in like the surface level or the visceral level of the violence and the carnage that happens. Not that I have any serious problem with anyone who writes that way, but I'm much more interested in the reaction or the way that a particular violence and death kind of impacts on the character. And so, you know, it was really easy with Nate to sort of just stay in his head and think about what would be, like, he's so shocked when he finds the body that he's not really able to kind of register all of the ornate details of the corpse, for example. He's really only dealing with the primary sensory overload of what he's trying to comprehend. And, like, that's actually a theme throughout the whole book. He is not really able to articulate a lot of what's happening to him. Like he's really just able to hold on to the basics of what's happening, and sometimes not even very well.
And this is 2SER 107.3. I'm Andrew Popel. You've been listening to my conversation with Ian Ryan about his fantastic new Aussie noir novel, The Student. It blew me away. I really cannot tell you how fascinated I was by this book. Now, we're going to take a track right now. This was from, this is from our feature album this week. It's from Waxahachie. I really hope I pronounced that right. I probably should have asked someone. Waxahachie, and the track is Silver.
Telling classic stories, smiling underneath the moon.
Good morning. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture. My name is Andrew Popel and I'm joined in the studio by Jen Worgan. Hey, Jen.
Hi, how's it going?
I am great. Now, Jen, you have been looking at a new YA novel and you've got a conversation for us today. What have you been reading?
Yes, so I've read How to Be by Bren McDibble. That's B-double-E. It's a great pun. So this book is actually for the 8 to 12-year-old demographic, and it's set in a dystopian future where bees are extinct and children are employed to pollinate flowers by hand. So the book follows the protagonist, Peony, who's taken by her estranged mother from the rural area where she lives and into the city, and then she fights to return to her farming community.
This sounds like a really fantastic setup, and it's just got this amazing connection with the science of today.
Yeah, it's really interesting that the book is about a world that's plausible, and it's, you know, we see these kinds of things happening today in some parts of the world.
It's so important that we connect with kids on these issues. Yeah. Let's have a listen to your conversation with Bren.
It's an in-depth point of view from Peony, who's she's 9 going on 10. So
yeah,
it had to be from that perspective of a child. And yeah, she only understands so much. And she doesn't know what the world was like before it became like this. All she knows is this is what the world is.
Yeah,
I understand this world. I have aspirations in this world to, you know, be a hand pollinator person. And it's too easy to terrify children when you talk about things like climate change or bee loss. Really, children can't do anything about it, but we do need to talk about it. So I wanted to present it in a way that wasn't so terrifying, like the worst has happened and this is what life is now.
Yeah.
It goes on. So that was kind of my aim, is not to terrify children, but to sort of provide a little bit of hope that, you know, might not get too bad and we can come back.
Yeah, well, I thought it felt quite hopeful. How did you approach or think about the balance of writing a story that deals with such serious issues without being too confronting or at the same time maybe even being too sentimental?
So I think approaching it like in a really intensive viewpoint of Peony and being the 9 and 10-year-old girl, you know, it's broken down to just that one viewpoint. So it's not going to be overwhelming because, of course, she's very successful in her world. She gets by and she knows what she knows. She knows family's important. She knows love's important. She knows, you know, she knows what she wants and she just goes after it. She's such a dynamic kid.
She really is. In terms of, like, developing that character as well, how did you approach that? Did you have her kind of fully formed from the start, or was it a process of figuring out who your protagonist would be?
Yeah, she kind of developed... I think along with the voice. I mean, the voice is very kind of like, you know, this is how it is, and this is my worldview, and just the way she talks helps define her character, because she's very forthright and strong and honest, and she kind of stands up for what she believes to be true and right, and you know, the way she calls the other kid that pushes you out of the tree stupid, and it kind of developed along with the voice. When you have that voice, your character has to be that person, I think. Yeah. The language was you know, it was really hard to think of what we might speak like in the future, so I wanted it to sound country.
Yeah,
but of course she would have had, like, all the farm kids speak pretty you know, a pretty strange language to each other. You know, people get blacked across the face, and she tells people not to diss her and diz her, or she says ain't like a country person. So there's all these different languages, and then they have the language of the farm, where she tells people to go stomp themselves because they're always stomping on the bugs in the orchard because they don't spray anymore. So they, you know, they stomp the bugs or feed the bugs to the chickens or whatever. So they've got their own funny language. And all the children are named after flowers or fruit or something that's, you know, really special now.
What sparked your interest in writing about, like, the issues of bee loss, especially for a children's book?
Well, just basically that we need to talk about it.
Yeah.
We're just avoiding the topic too much. because it is too overwhelming and too terrifying. So yeah. If we can break it down and put it in literature and make it non-threatening, perhaps we can talk about it, and then perhaps we can start doing things like pressuring people to take nicotinamides out of pesticides or something, you know, if nobody knows that there's a problem or that the problem is serious, then, you know, no one's going to talk about it. So, but really I just like to entertain children, and I saw the hand pollinators of Sichuan province in the Huffington Post article. They had these beautiful photos of people and trees. Yeah. And I thought, what an amazing setting for a child. I always write science fiction, so I wanted to set it in the future.
Yeah.
And when I saw all those amazing photos of those people up in the trees, and they weren't children, they were older people, and I thought, oh, that's their life now. That's how they live every morning. They get up in the cold and they get their little wands in their pouches and they climb up into the trees and pollinate flowers all day. So it just seemed, you know, it's real, it's happening, but it just seems so bizarre.
That's one thing that struck me, is that the world of this book is so plausible. Like you said, it's science fiction, but in a way it is happening now in some parts of the world. So
There's a new term out called climate fiction.
Oh.
And there's an argument about whether it's futuristic fiction or a current fiction.
How did you craft a world that is kind of plausible and frightening?
Well, I grew up in the country, so I kind of know what it's like to live in the country. And I grew up pretty poor, so I know what it's like to be poor and hungry and running around in bare feet all the time and one pair of shoes. But, so I think a lot of it is me coming through and living in the country. It kind of, those are the real elements. And I mean, it's pretty easy to imagine a time in the future where the rich are richer and the poor are poorer, and everyone in the middle is now poor, and everybody's struggling because, I mean, we just don't have food security in Australia. It's just not there. We import so much and our farmers are put upon so much, and they're struggling. So if things go wrong, if you don't have food security, then it's only the rich people who will eat, really. So
that's
true. It's easy to imagine that happening.
Yeah, it's interesting that you used your own experiences, but also the wider kind of global issues.
Yeah, you just kind of suck it all in. You go to, they have a lot of climate scientists come along to science fiction conventions and stuff and talk, and you just kind of suck in all these little bits of information and regurgitate them into a book, really.
Is there anyone in particular who you heard speak or who you looked at who really helped your work along?
I love Margot Lanigan and how she just, when she writes, she creates a strange world, but she doesn't explain it. She just plonks you in and straight into the world you are, and you know that people collect sea hearts from the beach, but you have no idea what a sea heart is. But she tells you how to prepare it, to cook it, and everything, and you think, we don't need to know the background. We're just living that life right now. So that's the kind of, and she's so lyrical and beautiful when she writes, and I thought that was a big influence. So.
In terms of your audience, I was wondering if you hoped that reading this novel would have a particular impact on the young people and I guess the older people who read it.
Yeah, it's for 8 to 12 year olds.
Yeah.
So it's not really an age that can have a lot of impact apart from talking to their parents about things and understanding things and perhaps introducing parents to new concepts. But as they grow, of course, when they become sort of teenagers and stuff, if they have that background interest in, you know, climate change, BLOS, whatever they choose to support, then that's something that they can start advocating for as they get older.
And I think being able to start the conversation, especially with young people, is a really positive step in the direction of being able to change things and address them.
Yeah, and hopefully this is, you know, such an entertaining book with Peony and what she wants out of life. And the kind of the background of BLOS, the way she goes about getting things, that, you know, people will, share it and read it and tell their friends to read it.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3, listening to Final Draft, and you've just been hearing a conversation between Final Draft producer Jennifer Worgan and Bren McDibble about Bren's new novel, How to Be. Jen, thank you so much for bringing us that interview. It sounded like a fascinating read, and I just want to pick up on one of the things that you guys were talking about, the way we need to connect with younger readers about these really important issues that are both scientific and impacting our lives. Do you think Bren is really going to hit the readership that she wants with this? Do you think the book will succeed with that younger demographic?
I think it will. I think the book definitely deals with some pretty heavy issues, but it doesn't feel like a depressing or an overwhelming read. It's very positive, and I think it has a lot of vibrancy.
So if you're out there, if you're really excited and you want a way to broach this topic with your kids, you'd recommend Bren McDibble's How to Be?
Yeah, pick up a copy.
Oh, fantastic. Now, we are almost at the end of the show, and what a fantastic show it's been. Like, there's always this amazing quality to Australian writing, but I feel like today I got to offer you up two really exciting new books. So huge thanks to Ian Ryan. He spoke to me about his new novel, The Student. Thanks so much to Bren McDibble and also to Jennifer Worgan. Jen is a producer here on Final Draft, and she brought us a conversation with Bren McDibble about her new YA cli-fi novel, How to Be. Now, do not go anywhere, because The Vulture's Nest is coming up next, and I don't think we've ever needed their lighthearted and interesting look of the week's events more. I just feel like every week we need someone to give us a little bit of perspective on what's been happening in the world. But before we get there, I'm going to give you a track. This is from Julia Y. Julia Y are going to be playing at Oxford Art Factory tonight. It's a big sort of ensemble gig celebrating Oxford Art Factory's birthday, including Flower Truck, Betty and Oswald. But this is from Julia Y. It is called Just One Night. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll be back next week with more books. My name's Andrew Popel. See you then. Bye.